True Crime Brewery contains disturbing content related to real-life crimes. Medical information is opinion based on facts of a crime and should not be interpreted as medical advice or treatment. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome to True Crime Brewery. I'm Jill.
And I'm Dick.
On a chilly January morning back in 2002, 12-year-old Ashley Pond disappeared on her way to the school bus stop in Oregon City, Oregon. 2 months after Ashley disappeared, Miranda Gaddis, age 13, also vanished while on her way to the same bus stop. Miranda and Ashley were good friends, and they lived in the same apartment complex. They were both friends with Mallory Weaver II, the daughter of local man Ward Weaver III. Join us at the quiet end for On the Way to the Bus Stop. After Miranda's disappearance, the FBI put together a task force to search for both girls. While some were holding out hope that they had run away, law enforcement and family members alike soon believed that the girls had been abducted. Ashley's mom believed that Ward Weaver was responsible, and she had good reason to believe that. Just 5 months before her disappearance, Ashley had accused Weaver of molesting her. So while the two girls were missing, he dug a hole in his yard and covered it up with cement. And as public opinion and law enforcement turned toward him as the primary suspect, Weaver made plans to move out of state. But it wouldn't be as easy as he thought it would be to escape his demons and his crimes.
So I was waiting for a nice Oregon case so we could do a review of one of Cascade Brewing's beers. Cascade makes some wonderful wild ales. And this is one of them. This is called Bourbonic Plague. Clever, huh?
Clever, yep. I don't know how appealing, but sure.
And again, it's a wild ale. It's 11.1% alcohol by volume. So we're going to be sharing this one. The beer is dark brown, has a small tan head, nice aroma, kind of that funky barnyardy aroma, some bourbon, dark fruit, and cinnamon. And we have a taste of bourbon, raisin, cinnamon, a little bit of orange. Medium-bodied beer, nicely tart. I think you'll enjoy it, Jill.
Well, you had me at Wild Ale, baby. Let's open it up.
Okay.
All right, let me settle in here at the quiet end. I have a little beer, and why don't you start us out? Tough case again this week.
It certainly is.
Yeah. But so, this is what our listeners are suggesting.
Well, we'll do it.
Gotta please them, sure.
So what we want to do today, though, is focus on the two girls abducted by Ward Weaver III, and that's in 2002. But it's not possible to do this thoroughly without delving into the early life of Weaver and the criminal history of his father, Ward Weaver Jr. Their complicated and abusive family history has to play some role in what happened to Ashley and Miranda. So we'll start there. So Ward Weaver III's father, Ward Francis Weaver Jr., is currently on death row in California for two murders. Weaver Jr. was a truck driver, and he was convicted in the 1981 killing of 18-year-old Robert Radford and of kidnapping, raping, and killing Radford's girlfriend, Barbara Lavoie. She was 23. Now, Robert Radford went to basic training for the Air Force in Colorado, and while he was there, he met 23-year-old Barbara Ann Lavoie. The two began dating and quickly became engaged. So then after Robert finished his basic training, he and Barbara were traveling together to his home in Edmonds, Washington, where Barbara could meet his parents. So the couple drove south to Pinedale, California, to meet Robert's grandmother. The plan was to ultimately arrive in Las Vegas, where Robert was to be stationed at Nellis Air Force Base. Once there, Barbara planned on flying back home to Colorado, staying there while Robert finished his first tour. And then once that was completed, the couple planned to marry and live together at whatever base he would be transferred to. So these two kids are in love, and they actually had a plan to spend their lives together and start a family.
Yeah, and that would just be shattered by an asshole, really. So on February 5th, 1981, Robert and Barbara arrived in Pinedale, California, and they spent that day visiting with Robert's grandmother. Then around 7 p.m., they left Pinedale and they headed for Las Vegas, which is about a six-hour drive. Their car broke down, though, about 2.5 hours into this trip, and this was near Tehachapi, California, just about a mile away from their exit. A guy named James Powell was driving home from work around 11 p.m. that night when he saw Robert and Barbara, and they were in their broken-down car on the side of the road with their emergency lights flashing. Powell offered the couple a ride back to Tehachapi, but Robert turned him down. He apparently declined this ride because they were headed in the opposite direction, and he told Powell that they would wait for someone who was going in their direction. Now, I would never have done that. I guess he's just very considerate to this stranger, because I think I would go with the first person.
Sure.
Although, you don't know about this guy either, so you really can't say that he would have known any better. But Robert's decision to turn down Powell's help turned out to be a fatal mistake. The next person who stopped for them was Ward Weaver Jr. Weaver Jr. was a long-haul truck driver, and he had been married twice, and he had three children with his first wife, Patricia, who went by Trish. Ward Weaver III was born in 1963, his sister Teresa in 1964, and Tammy in 1965. So Weaver Jr. was abusive, and his first wife divorced him in 1967. After divorcing Trish, Weaver Jr. enlisted in the Army, and he was sent to Vietnam. He returned from the war in 1969. Now, Weaver Jr. would later talk about the horrors committed by him and his fellow soldiers in Vietnam. For example, he would say that they had gang-raped a Vietnamese girl with her father's permission before the father killed his own daughter by slitting her throat. And I know there are horrible things like that that did happen over there, so these stories may have been true, but actually Weaver Jr. was a very damaged and violent man prior to the war. So Trish remarried after their divorce, but her new husband, Bob Budrow, was an abusive alcoholic. So this wasn't a big improvement for the family.
Doesn't seem to be.
So Budrow frequented local bars, and sometimes he didn't come home for days. He also ran up some big tabs, which Trish would have to pay. To keep him from spending his entire paycheck at the bars, Trish went out often at night to look for him and bring him home. She would even make up a bed in the back seat of her car so she could drive around at night with her children sleeping in the back. So, needless to say, the family had some financial difficulties, and then they had to live in subsidized housing, but still really couldn't afford to pay their bills.
In 1975, Budrow took the young Ward Weaver III on a work trip to Sacramento, California. And after a few weeks, a co-worker called Trish to tell her that Ward was being left in a motel room alone for long periods of time. So Trish insisted that Budrow bring her son home, but Trish would say that Ward stayed angry with her about letting Budrow take him to Sacramento for years afterwards. Trish believed that this incident changed her son for the worse. She would blame Budrow for her son's rage, believing that he endured horrible abuse while on that trip.
Well, that may have been true.
It may have been, but he'd already been showing a lot of behavioral issues before the trip.
Oh, absolutely. Now, his father, Ward Weaver Sr., had been an abusive man also. He sexually assaulted his wife, Dorothy, on a regular basis, and when Dorothy refused to have sex with him, he sometimes brought other women home and had sex with them in front of her. Many of the women brought into the home by him were not there willingly either, so these were rapes. Dorothy herself was emotionally unstable as well, and she often beat their children, including Ward Weaver Jr. She beat them with a belt, and she showed a deep hatred for all men. She would often pick up a knife and tell her son that all men should be castrated. So this is what he grew up with. And Dorothy was weirdly close to her son, Ward Weaver Jr., too. She would sleep in the same bed with him until he was 18 years old, and she often bit him as a way to discipline him. Still, they remained oddly close, and he would consult her about all of his big decisions in life, even as an adult.
So Ward Weaver Sr. also raped his own daughter, and he would sexually molest Ward Weaver Jr.'s two daughters, who were his own grandchildren. So you can see pretty easily that there was a long history of abuse and dysfunction in the Weaver family.
Oh, truly. It just breaks my heart to think about children growing up in this type of situation. And this story is just full of children growing up in horrible, horrible circumstances.
It is. It's just a real difficult thing to think about.
Oh, absolutely, yes.
So in addition to the abuse by Dorothy and Ward Weaver Sr., Ward Weaver Jr. physically and emotionally abused his sister growing up. When his sister was 6 years old and he was 7, he cut off one of her fingers with a hatchet. Now, he claimed that this was an accident. His sister would disagree with that story.
Yes, it seems that he did that on purpose because he was pretty sick.
Then when they were 7 and 8 years old, Weaver Jr. threatened to hang his sister, and he actually put a rope around her neck, left her tied to a tree in a field for hours before he came back and untied her. There were also incidents of arson, animal abuse, and sexual abuse of his sister done by Weaver Jr. This was both as a child and a teenager.
Yeah, so let's go back to when he returns from the war. He married his second wife, and she was a waitress he had met at a diner in Oroville, California. They had a son together in 1972 and named him Rodney. In 1978, Weaver Jr. went to prison for assaulting and raping an acquaintance, and he spent just a year and a half in prison, which I just can't believe you'd get a year and a half for raping someone. That's such a small sentence. So he was away for a year and a half, and his children were told that he was on a long vacation during that time. So now let's go back to 1981, when Weaver Jr. saw Barbara Lavoie and Robert Radford stranded on the side of that highway in California. He stopped and offered them help that night, and Robert and Barbara accepted his offer to take them as far as the Mojave Desert, where they could call for help and get their car fixed. So what we know about what happened next comes from Weaver Jr.'s confessions to a cellmate named Ricky Gibson, tape-recorded interviews between Weaver and the police, and Weaver's testimony at his trial.
Yeah, after driving about 5 miles with Barbara and Robert, Weaver pulled over and asked Robert to help him shift the load on the flatbed of his truck. So Barbara stayed in the cab of the truck. While Robert was bent over with his back turned, Weaver hit him on the back of the head with a cheater pipe. This is a 3 to 4 foot length of metal pipe that truckers use to gain leverage when tightening the bindings that restrain a load on the truck. But still, it's a 3 or 4 foot long lead pipe.
It's huge, very heavy.
That's going to do some damage.
Absolutely.
In fact, a later autopsy on Robert would reveal 11 separate lacerations to his head. So he did a number on him.
Yes, absolutely he did. And leaving Robert on the side of the road, Weaver went back to Barbara in the truck cab, pulled out a knife, and then had her sit with her head between her legs and her hands behind her. This was a technique he'd learned when transporting prisoners during his military service in Vietnam. Weaver then reversed direction and drove to Bakersfield, where he stopped and raped Barbara. He then drove toward San Francisco, pulled off the highway once more, and raped Barbara again.
Meanwhile, a witness reported having seen Robert Radford on the side of the road where Weaver had left him. So police responded to the scene and attempted to keep Robert alive, but he died on the way to the hospital. Police found a large amount of blood at the crime scene. And at the hospital, Robert's wallet with his Washington State driver's license was found. So the police were able to link Robert to the broken-down car a few miles away from where he had been found. And once they looked in the car, police found a woman's purse and some luggage. So they were believing that Robert had been traveling with a woman, so they opened the car door and found Barbara's ID. So they immediately issued a missing person report and organized a search. But unfortunately, it was too late for Barbara.
Barbara had been tied up and raped repeatedly in the sleeper cab area of Weaver Jr.'s truck. Then once they were in San Francisco, he delivered the cargo from his truck. Barbara likely could have gotten help as she was left alone in that cab for 45 minutes, but she was just so terrified that she stayed quiet and obeyed him. Weaver drove toward his home in Oroville, and after that stopped outside of town where he planned to leave Barbara. And as he tried to gag her, Barbara bit his hand, and she ended up taking a big chunk of flesh out of it. So Weaver would say that he planned on leaving Barbara alive that day, but when she bit him, he lost control. Now, that's possible, but certainly you can't believe anything he would say.
Well, the likelihood is that he was never going to let her go free.
Well, I just can't see how he could have, because she would have identified him.
Right.
Certainly. So Ward Weaver Jr. strangled Barbara. He dug a grave and buried her body there before driving into town to meet his wife, who was working a late shift in a local restaurant. Weaver decided to move Barbara's body, taking his wife's car and returning to the grave. He exhumed the body, put it in the trunk of the car, and drove home. And when he got home, Weaver's three children were awake, and they asked him about his bloody thumb. He told them he'd gotten in a fight and that they should stay in the house because his assailant might come back looking for him. Now, the reason why he did that is he didn't want them to see what he was up to.
Well, sure. He's got work to do. So with the children in the house, Weaver moved Barbara's body from the car to a shallow grave in his backyard. He had begun digging trenches in his yard for a sewer line, and he told his 10-year-old son and another boy to keep working on the digging project while he was away driving his truck. So then weeks later, he moved Barbara's body again, this time to a deeper grave in another part of his yard. He then built a wooden platform over the grave. He told his wife that he had built it for her so she could stand on it and hang out the laundry without getting her feet wet in the grass.
Very considerate.
What a guy. Then 2 months after killing Barbara and Robert, Weaver Jr. picked up two runaway hitchhikers, 15-year-old Michelle and her 18-year-old boyfriend David, in Oregon. He drove them 800 miles in his truck to California, where he called a friend and asked him to pick up David and kill him.
Yeah, just like that. Do me a little favor here.
His friend agreed, and he took David out into the country and shot him 3 times in the head. Then he threw his body down an embankment.
Yeah, so in the meantime, Weaver Jr. took Michelle back to Oroville, and he raped her repeatedly in the sleeper compartment of his truck. He's got an M.O. there. But David actually survived the 3 shots to his head, and he was able to crawl out of the embankment and wave down a car for help. Incredibly, he was able to give a detailed description of Weaver Jr. and his truck. But then by the time police caught up with Weaver Jr., he had already dumped Michelle, still alive, in a rural area of California. So Weaver Jr. and his accomplice were both arrested and sentenced to 42 years to life in prison for conspiracy to commit murder, kidnapping, and rape.
That's a pretty good sentence.
Yes, it's a good sentence.
Yeah. So while Weaver Jr. was in prison for the crimes committed against Michelle and David, he told his cellmate what he had done to Robert Radford and Barbara. The cellmate told police about Weaver's confession, and they searched the Weaver property. They uncovered Barbara's body from beneath the wood platform and a slab of cement, and she was identified by her dental records. She was also wearing the clothing she had been wearing when she was abducted, but her underwear was missing. And the body didn't have DNA evidence either because it was so badly decomposed. But after consulting with his mother, Weaver Jr. gave the police a full confession. He claimed to be on speed, and he was bored when he decided to commit the crimes. And at trial, Weaver Jr. took the stand, and he claimed mental illness.
Well, I would say he was mentally ill, but he knew what he was doing.
Yeah.
Isn't it really weird, that relationship with his mother, though?
Very twisted to me.
Yeah, because she was actually very abusive to him.
Yeah.
And then he calls her in to get her advice.
Yeah.
Very weird.
Very weird.
In 2 tape-recorded interviews, Weaver Jr. admitted that he had killed Robert and Barbara and had raped Barbara. He even drew a map to the area in rural Oroville, where he had first buried her body. Following that map, police found an indentation in the ground where Weaver said he had dug the first grave. Police also found some black electrician's tape on the ground nearby, which matched tape found on Barbara's body. Before Weaver was arraigned, his defense counsel claimed that they had doubts as to whether he was competent to stand trial. The court agreed to appoint 2 psychiatrists, Dr. Paul Cutting and Dr. Francis Criswell, to examine him. And on October 27, 1982, the court had reports from both doctors, and both had found that he was legally competent, and the trial court found him competent. So the trial would begin. Now, this is a pretty common thing for defendants to do when they don't have any other defense. Makes me think of Lori Vallow, who was just recently found competent to stand trial for murdering her children. But it's also something that Weaver Jr.'s son will use, so of course, we'll get into that later.
Yeah, well, you know, whatever works. If I can get me off of a charge of murder or something, why not go for it?
Well, yes, I understand that. It's true. But it was surprising that Weaver Jr. testified at his trial. He claimed that he had heard the voice of a female named Liddell in his head since he was 17 years old. He said he first heard an unnamed male voice, which contradicted this female voice, back when he was in Vietnam in 1968 and 1969. Then he said that he trusted the male voice because it had warned him of danger when he was in Vietnam and had saved his life. He also explained that he frequently used amphetamines to stay awake while driving his truck, and he said he had taken amphetamines on the day of the crimes and had actually not slept in a week and a half when he picked up this couple. So a lot going on there.
Surely is.
Yes.
So Weaver explained that when he picked up Barbara and Robert, he noticed how attractive Barbara was, and he became sexually aroused. Then his male voice started telling him that he should have sex with Barbara. At the same time, the female voice told him to leave Barbara alone. But the male voice told him that he would not get into trouble if he raped her.
I wonder if that male voice was actually Weaver himself.
Well, both voices are.
Well, and I would argue that he did not pick up Barbara and Robert and then notice that Barbara was attractive, because he'd gone by them and turned around to pick them up.
Oh, no.
So he was a predator after her from the get-go.
Yes, he was.
So Weaver said, "I couldn't just go against that voice. I just couldn't help it. I had to go along with what sounded like the most logical thing to do." So the most logical thing, in his opinion, was to rape Barbara. So the male voice told him to knock out Robert so he could be alone with Barbara. So Weaver decided to obey that voice. But then he claimed that he didn't think Robert would die because he had actually assaulted someone with that cheater pipe before, back in 1977, and that victim was fine, no serious injuries. Weaver also claimed that if he had wanted to kill Robert, he could have used the knife that he kept in his truck or some other more silent means of killing that he had learned while in the military. So Weaver testified that when he hit Robert, Robert fell off the truck and screamed. Weaver had told him to shut up, and when he didn't, he hit him a couple more times with the pipe. And he was taking full swings, holding that pipe with both hands. He said he didn't check to see if Robert was alive, but he returned to Barbara in the truck. And the female voice named Liddell was scolding him then, but the male voice was telling him, just ignore Liddell. So there you go. Perfectly reasonable explanation for the whole event.
Well, of course. So Weaver claimed he had not intended to kill Barbara, and after the second rape, he was looking for a safe but deserted area to drop her off. Then it began to get light as dawn approached. He took her to the Bay Area with him. And that's when he told Barbara to sit on the floor of his truck while he delivered his cargo. And she obeyed, sitting quietly in the truck for about 45 minutes. Weaver then drove to Oakland to pick up another load for local delivery. He was stopped along the way to Oakland by a California Highway Patrol officer. But Barbara obeyed Weaver and didn't call out to the police officer or try to escape the truck.
So I wonder, was she that terrified, or maybe she was actually unconscious? We don't really know what was going on at that point.
Yeah, because don't you think if you're stopped by a highway patrolman, it's worth saying something?
Well, you know, I'm not in the situation, so I really can't judge. You have to do what you think is best when you're in such a horrible situation.
But I think your suggestion that she might have been asleep.
Knocked out or drugged or something, yeah. That wouldn't have surprised me.
Now it's about 11 p.m., February 6, 1981. Weaver told Barbara he would tie her up and leave her under a bridge, and he would come back the next day when he was scheduled to drive back to Southern California. And at that point, he would release her in Los Angeles in a warehouse district, he told her. So he bound her with electric tape, but when he tried to gag her with some fabric diapers, she struggled, and that's when she bit him on the thumb and wouldn't let go.
Yeah, I wonder why he had fabric diapers. Cloth diapers in there. Maybe to clean something in the truck?
Possibly.
Yeah. Well, Weaver testified that he then hit her with his fist, and he blacked out and began strangling her. He said that he stopped when he realized she was no longer biting him, but by then she was already dead. He cried and said that he had never intended to kill her, even when she bit him. But that male voice told him to get rid of the evidence, so he buried her where he had killed her, then exhumed her body twice before finally burying her in his yard. So February 7th, 1981, Thomas Jenkins, an insurance adjuster, met with Weaver Jr. and noticed that he had several facial abrasions and scratches. He said that Weaver also had a large white bandage on his hand, and Weaver had told Jenkins that his thumb had been almost bitten off by another trucker. Weaver Jr.'s first wife, Patricia Trish Budrow, testified that Weaver Jr. hated to be bitten. She testified that she once bit his hand when they were wrestling in the car, and he became enraged and began choking her. Another time, she said, she bit his hand when they were wrestling on the floor. He grabbed her by the neck then and looked dazed and glassy-eyed. He later told her that he didn't know why he had choked her, but that he just really hated being bitten. He had told her that when he was a child, his mother would bite him until he bled as a way of disciplining him. Trish also testified that Weaver's mother would confirm this story and suggested that Trish should use the same method to keep her own children in line.
Well, yeah, that's how else would you do that?
Yeah, I don't know. The whole thing about biting him and then wrestling on the floor.
Yeah.
We've been married a long time. I don't think we've ever wrestled or bit each other, so I don't even know if you hate being bitten. I've never tried it.
Don't come near me.
Okay.
So Ward Weaver Jr. was convicted of first-degree murder in the deaths of Robert and Barbara. The jury deliberated for just 40 minutes.
Pretty convincing case.
That's some kind of record, huh?
That's pretty good.
He was sentenced to death, but death row sentences were suspended in California in 2019. So now he is a 78-year-old man who will very likely die in prison.
Yeah, he's been on death row, so I guess with some new law, he's going to be likely moved to the gen pop. But I think they have an area for elderly people.
Yeah.
So I don't think anything really is going to happen to him in that. The prosecutor in the case said that Weaver's truck route matched 26 unsolved hitchhiker homicides as well. But they've never been able to connect them with Weaver, and he's never been charged with any of those crimes. So it's a good thing he's not going to be getting out of prison.
Yeah, I wonder if the incidence of the hitchhiker homicides decreased once he was in prison.
That's interesting. I'd like to know that. That might be something to research someday when we have time on our hands.
Yeah.
So this just brings us up to Ward Weaver III, and this is the story we really want to talk about. Like I mentioned earlier, he was born in 1963, and he had two younger sisters. When he was in high school, he was overweight and quiet, but seemed like a normal, decent kid. As a teen, he worked at a fast food place and babysat his younger siblings. He had a stepbrother, Rodney, who was 9 years younger than him. But Ward Weaver III was not a bully in school. It really seems that he saved his violent tendencies for home and for his siblings. He hit and emotionally tormented his brother and sisters. He actually beat and raped at least one of his sisters by the time he was a 12-year-old. In 1981, when he was 18, he was investigated for sexual abuse against a teenage relative. I believe it was a cousin, but the name was not released. But he joined the U.S. Navy Reserve, and the police decided not to press charges against him because he would be shipping out soon. I don't see how that is a reason at all. Makes no sense to me.
I was just going to ask you that question. So
they didn't want to bother, it really seems like.
We don't have an answer.
But why would you want to send a sexual abuser into the Navy Reserve?
You got me.
To just victimize more people. It's not the same as putting him in jail. So I don't understand that decision or agree with it necessarily. While he was in the Navy, he was a cook aboard the aircraft carrier USS Coral Sea and stationed in the Philippines. And it was in the Philippines that he met his first wife, Maria Stout, in a bar. But between January and April of 1982, Weaver had 5 unauthorized absences, and he was also drinking heavily. So in May of 1982, he received an other than honorable discharge. And this is actually the most severe type of military administrative discharge. Examples of behavior that could lead to an other than honorable discharge include security violations, acts of violence, conviction by a civil court with a sentence including prison time, or being found guilty of adultery in a divorce hearing, which seems silly compared to the other things, but it is a thing in the military. So in most cases, veterans who receive an other than honorable discharge cannot re-enlist in the armed forces or the reserves ever. But all we really know about Weaver's discharge is that he was drinking heavily and he had had a dereliction of duty. But there could certainly be more to it that we don't know.
So Weaver and his future wife, Maria, moved back to Portland, Oregon together. They lived in Trish and her second husband's finished basement. It's interesting dynamics.
Yes, well, the mother had remarried, and he moved back in with his mother and his stepfather, Budrow. But Weaver was super controlling of Maria to the point where he never let her leave the house without him.
Yeah, and they also fought all the time, even more than Trish and her husband. And they fought a lot.
Yeah, they fought plenty.
So they had moved back to Oregon in May. By July of that same year, Maria was in the hospital. She was 5 months pregnant at the time, and she told the triage nurse that her husband had slapped her and banged her head against the bed frame. She did have a visible lump on her head. The police were notified, and Weaver was arrested on suspicion of aggravated assault. But Maria refused to press charges, and she stayed with Weaver, gave birth to their son Francis Paul Weaver in December. Now, Francis would later be determined not to be Weaver's biological child. But this happened right around the same time that Weaver's father, Ward Weaver Jr., was charged for the murders of Barbara Lavoie and Robert Radford.
So Maria and Weaver III moved to Bakersfield, California, with their son after he was born. Weaver visited his father in jail several times, and in 1984, Maria and Weaver III were married. Weaver and Maria had a second child together, and the family became well known by the police because there were repeated domestic violence calls to their house. The home was even deemed to be dangerous to their children, and the children were taken into state custody for quite some time. Weaver rarely held a job, and Maria survived off of welfare benefits. In 1986, Maria and Weaver III were staying with the Ordonia family in Fairfield, California, who had a family business selling Filipino products at flea markets and different venues. And they really liked Weaver in the beginning because he was very helpful. So the family invited the couple to stay with them until they could get back on their feet and find a place of their own. So that was very gracious and kind of them. You know, they really put themselves out. How many people will let a family move into their house that they don't even know that well?
They don't even know who these people are, basically.
Well, not really, yeah. But they trusted him.
Yeah, misguidedly.
Yeah, because Weaver attacked the Ordonia's teenage daughters.
Yeah, one day when Weaver was out drinking and drugging, he called the Ordonia's for a ride home from a bowling alley. So they sent their two teenage daughters in the family van to pick him up. Once in the van, Weaver got the girls to pull over. He hit 15-year-old Jocelyn Ordonia with a big concrete block. And then while Jocelyn was slumped over, he grabbed 16-year-old Jennifer and attempted to rape her. Now, Jennifer managed to get away from him and waved down a car on the street. She had considered Weaver a family friend, almost like an uncle. Jennifer, shocked, had screamed at him, "What are you doing?" Weaver never said a word to her, she would later say. He wore this blank, frightening expression. Now, he was arrested the next day, and he went to prison for 3 years due to these attacks.
Well, I just can't help but wonder, what if they had sent just Jennifer and not Jocelyn? If he only had one of them to contend with, it could have ended a lot worse.
Oh, yeah.
You know, he could have easily killed her, is what I mean to say. But after he was released from prison that time, Weaver and Maria relocated to Canby, Oregon. And they ran a gift shop there for a while, but it shut down pretty soon after it opened. Weaver also sold cocaine and meth during this time, so that could have had something to do with the business failure.
Possibly.
Yeah. So while in Oregon in 1989, Maria gave birth to their daughter, Mallory. Now, Mallory's important to remember because she was a good friend of Miranda Gaddis and Ashley Pond in 2002 when those two girls disappeared. So not surprisingly, the Weaver marriage continued to be volatile and dysfunctional after Mallory was born. The couple were evicted from their mobile home after repeated police visits related to domestic violence. In 1993, Maria filed a restraining order against Weaver, and they finally did divorce. So she got out. Good for her.
Good for her, that's for sure. So shortly after the divorce, Weaver got himself a new girlfriend. She was 18 years old. Her name was Christy Sloan, and she had just graduated from high school, and Weaver's 31. True love. Christy, though, was soon unhappy with her life with Weaver. He physically abused his children in front of her, and he was also very controlling of her, exactly as he had been with Maria. In July 1995, he beat Christy with a cast iron skillet. She screamed as he continued to beat her, but she would later say that his eyes looked blank and he seemed to be in a trance.
Well, that's very similar to what Jennifer Ordonia had said.
Yeah.
And the one who had bit the thumb. He'd kind of gone crazy with that as well.
He's not aware of what's going on.
Well, I wouldn't go that far. But certainly there was an evilness that came over him, and he couldn't be talked out of it.
Right.
Right. But the neighbors called the police that time, and he was arrested and taken to jail. And then in September, Christie refused to testify against him. She said she was too afraid of him and dropped the case. But then she went back with him in October, a month later, and ended up marrying him in February of 1996. Then in 1997, Weaver's children moved in with the couple. Not sure where Maria was at this time, but Weaver had custody of the children off and on throughout their lives. There was a lot of back and forth. But still, for that next year or so, the Weaver family did seem happy, until August of 1997, when Weaver began having an affair with a woman at his work, and that's when Christie finally left him. Weaver and his new girlfriend Tammy rented a small house together on South Beaver Creek Road in Oregon City, Oregon. Of course, they fought a lot, and their relationship was very off and on. He hadn't changed. But Tammy, Weaver, his son Francis, who was 16 at that time, and daughter Mallory, who was 10 years old, moved into that house together. Now, Mallory was a popular girl. She had many friends, and her house was a popular place for the girls to hang out and have sleepovers. Very disturbing, considering who her father was. Yikes.
You think?
Yeah, I think.
So when Mallory was 12, she became friends with Ashley Pond and Miranda Gaddis. Both girls were often at Mallory's house, and the three girls went to the same middle school, Gardner Middle School, and they were in the same dance class. Ashley and Miranda lived in an apartment complex called the Newell Creek Village Apartments, which was located behind the Weaver's rental house. Both girls lived with their mothers, and both girls had endured sexual abuse.
Yeah, so up until meeting Mallory Weaver and being in the company of her abusive father, these girls had already suffered some pretty difficult lives. Now, all three of them rode the same school bus together, and the bus stop was actually right across the street from the Weaver home. So when one or all of the girls would miss their bus, Weaver often did drive them to school. But like I said, Ashley Pond had not had an easy life. Her biological father was indicted on 40 counts of raping and sexually abusing her over a 4-year time period, and she told some of her friends that her mother, Lori Pond, had a problem with alcohol and that she really neglected her and her two younger siblings. And this seems to be true. There were domestic calls made to the police and several incidents reported to the Department of Human Services. Ashley had reported to at least one friend that two other men had been molesting her as well. So how does this happen to a child? It's just like she has a sign on her saying, "Victimize me," and no one's protecting her. But then when a teacher at Ashley's school saw Ward Weaver kiss her on the lips when he dropped her off at the school one day, the teacher reported what she had seen to the principal.
Yeah, what came of that?
Well, we'll get a little bit more into that, but certainly not what should have happened.
So in June and July of 2001, Ashley went with Weaver, his wife, and Mallory on a trip to California. And then when they got back, Ashley moved into the Weaver house. Apparently, Ashley's mom was okay with this. Ashley had been having issues with her mother, and her home life was less than ideal. So maybe Lori trusted Weaver because he seemed like a family man? We don't know.
Well, and he did have a wife there at the time.
He did.
So she might have thought, well, she's staying with this nice family. And I'm a single mom having trouble. But, you know, we know Lori wasn't very responsible. She had her own serious issues. But it seemed to be a real gathering place for the young girls. Mallory's friends were often at the Weaver house during the daytime and for overnights. But that August, Ashley accused Weaver of molesting and attempting to rape her. So she left the Weaver home and moved back with her mom at the Newell Creek Village Apartments. She did confide to a teacher at her school that Weaver had told her that she could not tell anyone about him molesting her, or he would testify against her at her father's rape trial and tell everyone that she was a liar. So how horrible and overwhelming for a child to be dealing with this stuff.
Yeah, 12-year-old.
As a woman in my 50s, I couldn't deal with it. How does this little girl deal with it?
I know.
Just makes you want to cry. She's 12 years old, her mother is not helpful, and she must have just felt trapped and helpless. It's really dreadful.
So the abuse was reported to the police and to the deputy DA. And the DA reported the abuse to the child abuse hotline on August 31st. That report was sent to child welfare on September 5th. but the claim was not investigated by the police. The usual story, overworked system, a lot of working already on claims against Ashley's father. So much stuff that her case got lost in the shuffle.
Well, I mean, that's a really simple way out. There were certainly mistakes made.
Oh, yeah. Now, the documents detailing what was done and not done by the State Department of Health and Human Services have not been released to the public. On September 6th, Ashley's father pleaded no contest to attempted unlawful sexual penetration, and he was sentenced. Are you ready for this? He was sentenced to 120 months of probation.
Holy shit. How is that even possible?
Got me.
How can a man rape a girl repeatedly and not even go to prison for it? This is just really shitty.
Well, some sort of plea deal.
Well, they dropped 40 counts of sexual assault. But still. Why? A caseworker was still involved with the family, and child welfare was still getting reports of abuse from Ashley, you know, now about Ward Weaver. Ashley even told some family members that she was afraid of him. Of course she was. It seems that she and Mallory Weaver had a falling out over this, and then some of the other girls were saying that Ashley was lying. So they were kind of ganging up on her after that, because they all thought he was the fun guy. He would buy them stuff and let them watch movies and all this crap. So not only had she been abused and didn't have a lot of support at home, but now she's being ostracized by her friends. She was avoiding the Weavers as much as possible, too, because she was afraid. But then, according to other girls who spent time at the Weaver house, Ashley had been sleeping in the same bed with Weaver back when she was living at his house. Tammy had been in and out of the house, so she wasn't there all of the time. And I think she actually knew that something was going on with him and this girl. Ashley had said that Weaver just usually laid on top of her, but then he had tried to rape her, and that's when she had left. And that's when she decided to report him. So this was just a girl in a horrible position.
Truly. But let's take a little break so I can rinse my brain out, and then we'll go into Ashley's disappearance.
And now a word from True Crime Brewery After Dark. It was just an ordinary night. The dogs were fed and walked. Dick prepared a delicious vegan dinner. Afterward, I loaded the dishwasher while Dick poured us each a glass of wine. But then suddenly, I vanished. But Dick didn't worry. Oh no. He didn't call 911 or go door to door in the neighborhood looking for me. I was just out back on my lounge chair, scoring some quality time with Best Fiends. I'd done it before, I'll admit it. And he knew I would do it again and again.
Yeah, others may have been concerned about your mysterious disappearing act. But we've been married for a long time, and I know Jill very well. She's having just as much fun with Best Fiends as I do, so it's no mystery why she sneaks off to play. Best Fiends is a mobile puzzle game that anyone can download and play, whether you have minutes or hours. It's always right there on your tablet or phone. The more you play, the more challenges you face. New characters and puzzles are added all the time, and there are also fun events when you get to compete for in-game rewards.
I do play often, and I'll admit that I do lose track of time once I'm in my Best Fiends playing zone. Best Fiends has new content and characters added constantly, so you'll never get bored. I've just reached level 920, and with literally thousands of levels, I never have to worry about running out of gameplay, because the more you win, the more challenges you face. It's fun to strategize and figure out which matches to make to cause explosions and take down those dreaded slugs. Power up your favorite fiends to new levels and make them stronger. And with offline play, you can even have fun if you lose your Wi-Fi connection.
So download your new favorite getaway, Best Fiends, for free today on the App Store or Google Play. You'll even get $5 worth of in-game rewards when you reach level 5. That's friends without the R. Best Fiends.
Ashley Pond's bus stop was about a 10-minute walk from the Newell Creek Village Apartments where she lived with her mom. On January 9th, 2002, Ashley disappeared on her way to that bus stop. She never made it to school. Her mom, Lori, saw Ashley just before 8 a.m. Ashley was running late, and she ran out trying to catch the bus. Despite Ashley's troubled home life, she wasn't a child who people who knew her thought would run away. She was popular, a good student, and very involved with her dance class, too. and she had dance practice that day after school. But of course, she never showed up.
So Ashley's sister Brianna called her mother, Lori Pond, at 1:30 in the afternoon on that day to tell her that she hadn't seen Ashley at school that day. Lori called the police to report her daughter missing. Ashley never made it to school at all, so she had been missing for several hours by the time the police were contacted. When Lori spoke to the police dispatcher, she told the woman that her daughter would never run away. Lori had already called Ashley's friends, and she learned that no one had seen her at all that day. Ashley had left the house wearing blue jeans, a blue sweatshirt, and white sneakers. She had her stuff for school with her, but had not taken anything that would point to her leaving on her own.
So Lori and Ashley's friends looked for Ashley that afternoon, including her good friend Miranda Gaddis, who lived in the same apartment building. Lori remembered her daughter saying goodbye to her on the morning of January 9th, and Ashley's younger sister Brianna remembered telling Ashley to get up at around 7 a.m. But no one remembered seeing Ashley at the bus stop that morning. Still, it wasn't that unusual for Ashley to miss her bus. In the past, she sometimes would stop by the Weaver home to see Mallory, and sometimes Mallory's father, Ward Weaver, would drive them to school. But we know that Ashley had been avoiding the Weaver house that January. She had been ever since Weaver had tried to rape her. On the morning that Ashley disappeared, Ward Weaver told the police that he had been at home late that morning and had problems with his burglar alarm. His daughter Mallory wasn't home because she'd spent the night at her mother's house, but Weaver didn't tell the police that.
The next morning, still with no sign of Ashley, Oregon City Police Detective Viola Valenzuela Garcia went to Gardner Middle School to speak with Ashley's friends and acquaintances. She interviewed 13-year-old Miranda Gaddis in the school counselor's office, and when questioned, Miranda said that she believed that Ashley had run away. She said that Ashley had been angry with her mother and told her that her life sucked. Miranda told the detective that Ashley's mom had a drinking problem and could be really awful to Ashley. And Ashley had told Miranda that her mom locked her out of the apartment for hours at a time for no good reason. Before Christmas, Miranda said, Ashley had told her that she wanted to run away and get away from all the bad stuff that was going on.
That poor girl. Miranda then went on to tell the detective that most of the other kids were being mean to Ashley lately. According to Miranda, this had started after Ashley had told everyone that Mallory's father had been touching her. And the kids believed that Ashley was lying about this, so they were mad at her. But coincidentally, or not so coincidentally, the next student the detective interviewed was Mallory Weaver. Mallory said that she and Ashley had not been close when Ashley disappeared, but they had been as close as sisters before that. Mallory said that Ashley had been like part of her family, and that her dad was actually really kind to Ashley. She said he had bought Ashley some clothes and a bike. But then at the beginning of seventh grade, Mallory said, Ashley had begun telling people that Ward Weaver had tried to rape her. Then she'd moved out, returning to her mother's home. Mallory said that if Ashley had run away, it was likely because of the issues with her mother, Lori Pond, and Lori's excessive drinking.
So the detective asked Mallory if she would take her to some places around the Newell Creek apartments where kids would hang out. Mallory agreed to this, but the detective had to get her father's permission. So she called Ward Weaver III at his workplace. Weaver was polite and helpful over the phone, and he said he wanted to do anything he could to help. Then he started telling the detective things about Ashley. He said that there had been trouble between Ashley and her mom, so he had taken her in for several months. And he suggested that she may have run away because of family problems. He said he had had no contact with Ashley for several days before she disappeared, and she hadn't been at his house for months. Then he added that she had made false accusations against him, and she needed professional help. He also suggested that Ashley's mother be looked at because she hung out with a tough crowd. Then before hanging up, he said to the detective, call me anytime if you need to.
Yeah, so he's super helpful.
He's a guy.
Then a possible lead came in. Mallory Weaver went to her vice principal and said that her uncle Paul had seen Ashley at a mall 4 miles outside of Oregon City. Now, Uncle Paul wasn't really her uncle. He was Paul Myers, Ward Weaver's best friend. Detective Garcia contacted Weaver again at his job to find out more about Paul and the sighting. Weaver was oddly cheerful on the phone for these circumstances, which really kind of made her skin crawl. He told her that Paul was his closest buddy and that Paul had told him that he had seen Ashley at the mall after she disappeared. So Weaver gave the detective Paul's phone number so she could follow up on that. And after speaking with Weaver, Detective Garcia had a really bad feeling about him. He just seemed totally unaffected by Ashley's disappearance. Didn't seem like a normal parent would act, especially since he supposedly had been close to her. And rather than showing concern for her or the other children in the neighborhood, he was actually flirting with the detective and joking around.
The best defense is a good offense, right?
I suppose, yeah. He was really offensive, that's for sure.
So Paul Myers was surprised to hear from the detective. He told her that there must be some misunderstanding. He told Weaver that he saw Ashley at the mall before her disappearance. And he said that maybe his conversation had been misinterpreted by Mallory. So it seems like there was some manipulation by Weaver in using his friend and daughter to throw off the investigation.
Oh, it certainly does. It seems like he told his daughter to do that.
Yeah.
To contact the detective. So police detectives and the chief of police held a press conference concerning Ashley's disappearance. A detective told the reporters that the case had moved from a probable runaway case to a missing and in danger case. Ashley had not taken any clothing or money with her, and she'd been missing for over a week by then. She hadn't had any contact with any friends or family members. So, he said that they were now looking at any adults who had been in Ashley's life, and there were 4 to 6 adults who they were interested in. The police chief said that the apartment complex and Lori Pond's home had been searched and nothing suspicious had been found. Because of the way the case was turning toward foul play, the FBI, the Oregon City Police, and the Oregon State Police were all working together. With the assistance of the FBI, a new, more intensified search was beginning immediately. On the morning of January 23rd, which was about 2 weeks after Ashley's disappearance, a reporter from a local Portland station stood at the bus stop where the middle school students from Ashley's neighborhood would be picked up for school. There were 10 to 12 students standing there waiting and chatting. The reporter, Anna Song, introduced herself to them and began asking questions. And a friend of Ashley's, 13-year-old Miranda Gaddis, spoke with the reporter. She said that it was hard to believe that something had happened to her friend. She said it's really different and sad. Miranda said that she had no idea what had happened to her friend, but now that she'd been gone so long, she thought Ashley had been kidnapped or something. Now, it's really stunning because a few weeks later, Miranda Gaddis would be missing too. So if you're a reporter and you're interviewing the friends of a missing girl, you would never imagine that one of the friends you're interviewing would be missing soon afterward.
You certainly wouldn't.
Linda O'Neill, a private investigator, was a member of Ashley's extended family by marriage. Her husband, Philip, was once married to Ashley's grandmother. So Linda was not close with Laura Pond or Ashley, really, but she did know the family. For the first few days of the disappearance, Linda had agreed with the police in Oregon City that Ashley had likely run away and would be back. But after a week went by with no sign of Ashley anywhere, she began to worry that Ashley had been abducted. So using her connections to the family and to the police force, Linda began to investigate the case on her own. And she learned that Lori was being closely looked at by investigators. But Lori believed that Ward Weaver was responsible for her daughter's disappearance.
March 1st was Ashley's 13th birthday. So the family gathered to remember her, still not sure if she's alive or dead. The police were watching Lori and her boyfriend around the clock to see if they did anything suspicious. The couple was far from perfect, but their behavior gave no indication that they had been involved in Ashley's disappearance. Then on Friday, March 8th, reporters were back at the Newell Creek Apartments. A second girl disappeared that morning, from the same neighborhood. Miranda Gaddis, a friend of Ashley's, had disappeared on her way to the school bus stop. Miranda's a friend of hers, same girl who had been interviewed by the local TV reporter after Ashley's disappearance. No witnesses nor any evidence of a crime. In fact, no one had even seen Miranda at the bus stop that morning.
Well, 2 weeks before Miranda Gaddis's disappearance, Mallory Weaver had her 13th birthday party at her father's house. Her mother, stepmother, and Miranda Gaddis had attended, and Weaver's first wife, Maria, would later tell the police that Weaver was upset with Miranda because Miranda had warned another teen at the party not to spend the night there because Weaver had molested Ashley and he might molest her too. Miranda had gone to the Weaver house often in the mornings to walk with Mallory to the school bus stop. After Miranda's disappearance, Weaver initially told the police that he had been home taking care of his sick daughter, but Mallory had spent the night before at her mother's house. Then 3 days after Miranda went missing, Weaver poured a concrete slab in the back of his house. He had this old disassembled hot tub leaning against the back wall, which he said he planned to install there. Okay, now this was a rental too, though, so that's a little odd. And, of course, the timing is very, very suspicious.
Well, that's what does it. Yeah.
Yes, yes. And then what you think of what his father did is so eerily similar with the cement slab.
Yeah, are they aware at this point of the family history?
They were pretty soon, yeah. Once they did the background check on him, yeah. They did figure that out. I think initially they were doing the background check, and they didn't put the third because they didn't realize. And then they got all the information on his father and realized that was his father.
Yeah.
After 5 p.m. on the evening of Miranda's disappearance, the police brought in reserve officers to do extensive canvassing of the apartment complex and the neighboring area. Miranda's mother, Michelle Duffy, was, of course, very distressed. She didn't believe that Miranda would have run off, and she said that Miranda had been very upset over Ashley's disappearance. Now the fact that a friend of her daughter's had been missing for a couple of months and now her daughter's missing certainly would have added to her unease. On the morning of her disappearance, Miranda had been awake when her mother left for work at 7:30. She had said goodbye and locked the door behind her. Michelle got home from work about 2:15, but Michelle had learned that Miranda had not been at school all that day. It was actually Miranda's older sister, Mariah, who attended the same middle school, who had called Michelle in the middle of the day to tell her that Miranda was not at the school. They hadn't walked to the bus stop together that morning because Mariah had spent the previous night at the home of her dance team coach. So back at that time, the school didn't always call parents if their child had not arrived at school. Now this is something that I think all schools do automatically. But it wasn't the case here and then, at that time or at this place.
And after finding nothing at the apartment complex to explain Miranda's disappearance, detectives expanded their search. While in the area of the bus stop, Ward Weaver's house caught their attention. It was the only single-family house in the area. So thinking that maybe they had witnessed something, detectives approached Weaver's house and knocked on the door. It was raining, and the detectives walked through overgrown grass on the front lawn. They noticed a run-down shed near the back of the half-acre property. So Weaver opened the door quickly, with a smile on his face. Joking, he held up his hands and said, "I give up, officers. Take me away." Now, the officers obviously did not find this very funny. They explained that another girl had gone missing from the neighborhood, Miranda Gaddis. They asked if they could come inside. So Weaver opened the door wide and invited them in. Inside, a detective told Weaver that they were looking for information about Miranda. Weaver said that he hadn't seen her, but she was a friend of his daughter.
Yeah, so Mallory was on the living room couch when they came in, and Weaver agreed to let her speak with the police. Mallory had not gone to school that day. She'd been sick and had spent the night before at her mother's. So she'd seen Miranda the day before, and everything had seemed normal, she said. When asked if Miranda had come to his house that morning, Weaver shook his head, but he did agree to let them look around his house. They didn't find any clues there. Weaver agreed to a quick inspection of his shed, but nothing was found there either. Before they left, the detectives shook Weaver's hand and thanked him for cooperating, and he told them he was glad to help and they should just call on him any time.
What a guy.
Now, police believed that whoever had taken the girls knew them and their daily routines. This case was covered on the local news, on Unsolved Mysteries, the BBC, the New York Times, Dateline, and America's Most Wanted. So it became a very high-profile case, not just in Oregon, and not just in the United States, but actually internationally. Ward Weaver III was the primary suspect, and he really seemed to enjoy the attention. He seemed to think that he could outsmart law enforcement, and he took two polygraph exams, which he failed. He invited TV crews into his home and spoke about how he was such a good guy and a victim of a campaign to make him look bad. He complained that he was being looked at because of his father's murder convictions. He said because his father was so bad, the press was trying to make him look bad too. Just wasn't fair, he said. So local KATU news reporter Anna Song, who'd been covering the case since Ashley's disappearance and who had interviewed Miranda Gaddis, was invited into Weaver's house and she was given a tour on July 3, 2002. This was videotaped and you can actually see it on YouTube. He definitely seemed to enjoy all of the attention. In the video, he walks around his house, happily describing the sleepovers that they'd had there with Mallory's friends, including the two missing girls. And at one point, he actually chuckled and said, "You couldn't walk anywhere in my front room without stepping on a body." So it seemed that he was actually toying with the reporter, walking with her over a new cement slab in his backyard, and leaning on a freezer, which would later be determined to have been used in crimes against the girls. Lori Pond was convinced that Ward Weaver had taken Ashley and Miranda. Harry Oakes, a search dog trainer who was not really in with the established professionals in his field, had actually been training search dogs for years. When the investigators refused his help in the search for the two girls, he contacted Lori Pond and volunteered to help her. Lori met Harry and his dog Valerie at the Newell Creek Apartments property on March 10th and then again on March 15th. The dog ran toward the Weaver property. Harry did knock on the front door to get permission to be searching the Weaver's yard. Weaver's son answered the door and he told Harry that he didn't live there, but he agreed to call his father and ask for permission. So after he made the call, he told Harry that they could search the property as long as he kept his dog away from the new cement slab out back. He explained that his father was getting ready to install a hot tub there and he didn't want the dog messing up the cement. So yeah. That's a curious comment right there.
I guess it is, isn't it?
Well, how would a dog damage hardened cement?
It would be very difficult. Maybe
absolutely.
If they had a little jackhammer in their paws.
Aw, yeah. So it's just ridiculous.
Very much so. And of course, what happens? The search dog made a straight shot for the concrete slab. Boom. She stood over it and paced back and forth excitedly. Then she gave her alert, a disturbing howl. And she began to paw at the slab as if to dig it up. So Harry got frightened. He quieted Valerie and walked her off the property as quickly as he could. He walked straight to the nearby strip mall and called the police. On the phone, Harry explained the situation to a female officer. She took his phone number, but Harry didn't hear back from the police. He then wrote a letter to the chief of police detailing Valerie's reaction to Weaver's concrete slab. He sent copies of this letter to Lori Pond and to the FBI task force.
Well, meanwhile, Linda O'Neill's suspicions about Weaver were growing. The girls' teachers, dance coaches, and Weaver's ex-wives all told her stories of his very disturbing and inappropriate behavior. There was the teacher who saw Weaver drop off Ashley at school. Now, Weaver was a man in his 30s, and this teacher saw him giving a passionate kiss to 12-year-old Ashley. A family friend said that Ashley had spent weeks at a time at the Weaver's house, often sleeping in his bed with him. This friend also said that Weaver was angry with Miranda because she had been telling girls in the neighborhood to stay away from Weaver's house because he might molest you.
By July, Ashley had been missing 7 months and Miranda for 4 months, but it seemed the FBI wasn't close to solving the case. Linda O'Neill was by now convinced that they should be looking more closely at Weaver. She called the FBI, but they told her they didn't see him as a suspect and they didn't need the help of a private investigator. And she couldn't believe it. In fact, she was so upset that she contacted Portland Tribune reporter Jim Redden. She and the reporter showed up at Weaver's house where they did a surprise interview.
Yeah, but then Linda couldn't believe it when Redden told her that Weaver seemed like a just nice, normal guy. He actually thought Weaver seemed honest and forthright. Linda, along with many others in the community, feared that he was going to take another girl. But Redden did go ahead and write the article, and this put Weaver's name in print for the first time. He was the center of attention, but seemed to really be enjoying it. He even was interviewed on Good Morning America, where he said that Ashley was better off hiding out wherever she had found a place to live. Again, putting the blame on Ashley's mother and portraying Ashley as this troubled child who had run off. Another suspicious thing, in July, Ward Weaver sold his 1977 Camaro, which was the car that he usually drove, and all of the carpet and lining inside of this car had been removed. The buyer had purchased the car anyway, but the carpet has never been found.
Lori Pine was convinced that Ward Weaver III had abducted and killed her daughter and Miranda Gaddis. Ashley's stepmother, Mary Campobasso, was also convinced that Ward Weaver III was the culprit. Unhappy with the police response, Mary brought a sign with bold print to the Weaver property. It read, "Dig me up," and she taped it to the cement slab.
I like her.
Yeah. She was filmed by local news, and she said that there is a bad smell near the slab as well. Other people agreed that there was some kind of weird smell back there.
Yeah, so all these mothers, Linda O'Neill, a lot of people are convinced that the girls are buried there. The property was attracting a lot of people then who either suspected Weaver or were just curious. The owner of the property, Weaver's landlord, posted an eviction sign on the door, and Weaver's landlord was also putting up no trespassing signs around the property to try and keep people from gathering there. But then he discovered several fly strips completely covered with flies in that rundown shed. By early August, Weaver was not so happy about being the prime suspect in these girls' disappearances. He now wanted to get away from all the media attention. He told friends he was planning on moving to either Idaho or Mexico, which is weird because those places are not at all similar. So I'm not sure why those were the two choices. But just the fact that he was thinking of moving really alerted a lot of people. Where is he going to go and who is he going to victimize next? But Weaver moved his things out of his house, which was a rental, and he was all set to leave Oregon behind when he attacked and raped his son's girlfriend. It's like he couldn't even help himself. This was 19-year-old Randy Oneida, and she was also the mother of Weaver's grandchild. So on August 13th, 2002, Weaver asked Randy to drive him to the DMV to reinstate his suspended driving license. And on the way there, he asked her if she would mind stopping at his house to pick up a few things. Randy was confused because she thought he'd already moved all of his things out the previous week. But Weaver told her there were just some papers there that he had left behind. So Randy agreed and drove to Weaver's house. It was raining, and he asked her to follow him inside because he had something in there to show her. So Weaver stood in an empty bedroom waiting. When Randy came in and shut the front door, he called her into the room. Now remember, this is the grandfather of her baby, so she trusted him.
Yes.
But as soon as she got in that room, she saw something very sinister in his eyes. Things changed. He grabbed her and put her on the floor. Then he straddled her and pinned down her arms. As she tried to scream for help, he put his mouth over hers and stuck his tongue in her mouth. He threatened her and put his hand around her throat. She did fight him and tried to talk him out of assaulting her, reminding him that they were actually family. But Weaver raped her and then stayed on top of her. And at this point, she was convinced he was going to kill her. So she managed to escape the bedroom and headed for the front door. Fortunately, he couldn't catch up to her because he was pulling up his pants. So Randy was naked. She grabbed a tarp from the front room and went running out the front door in the rain. Randy ran down Beaver Creek Road screaming, naked except for that tarp flapping around her shoulders. At a red light, a man driving down the road saw a naked girl in front of his car, and she began banging on the hood, screaming for help. Randy jumped into the passenger side of his car and crouched down on the seat. She screamed for him to get her out of there and said, "He's after me." The man drove off, and they stopped at a strip mall. Randy ran into a shoe store and begged to use their phone. The clerk took her into the back office where Randy called 911. And within hours, Ward Weaver was arrested and held in jail, charged with her rape.
Now, the FBI didn't connect the rape case to the cases of the missing girls until Weaver's son, Randy's boyfriend, it's Francis Weaver, He called the police and told them that his father had confessed to him that he had killed Ashley and Miranda, and he believed the girls were buried on Weaver's property. Now, this confession had happened some time back, and Francis had somehow not shared this information with Randy, the mother of his child, or with the police.
Yeah, and he could have gotten her killed by not telling her this.
Yeah.
Because she trusted him and went with him.
Entirely.
Into a vacant house, yeah. While Weaver was in custody for the rape, the property was searched with earth-penetrating radar and cadaver dogs. At 11:15 p.m. on the night of August 23rd, a spokesperson for the FBI task force held a news conference for the media in front of the Weaver house. The entire property was closed off with a chain-link fence, and she explained that they believed they would find evidence from the cases of the two missing girls on that property. The next morning, the property was surrounded by news crews and residents of Oregon City. Miranda's body was found out in a box in the rundown shed on the property. That's where all those flies had been. He had kept her body in the chest freezer before moving it out to the shed when he was planning to move from the property. This freezer had actually contained Miranda's body during that video-recorded tour of the house that was done with Ward Weaver and Anna Song and had been shown on KATU News. In fact, Weaver had leaned on that freezer as he spoke with Anna Song that day. He'd even tapped on the top of it during this tour. Seemed like he was just taunting her.
Yeah, almost.
Seems like he was proud of this.
So the next day, while a vigil was being held for Miranda, Ashley's body was found. Investigators finally dug up the concrete slab and found her in the ground. This was the same spot where Valerie the search dog had alerted 5 months earlier. Ashley Pond's body had been beneath that slab all along.
Yeah, so the dog trainer had told the police, the FBI, he'd sent out letters even, about the dog alerting at that cement. But 5 months passed, and nothing was done. If it hadn't been for the rape attempt, who knows?
Mm-hmm.
So Weaver was finally charged with 6 counts of aggravated murder, 2 counts of abuse of a corpse in the second degree, 1 count of sexual abuse in the first degree, 1 count of attempted rape in the second degree, another count of aggravated murder, another count of attempted rape in the first degree, 1 count of sexual abuse in the first degree, 1 count of sexual abuse in the second degree, and another 2 counts of sexual abuse in the third degree. So this is enough that he could be kept in prison for his life, obviously. Even after the girls' bodies were recovered on his property, though, Weaver denied murdering them and tried to defend himself. In some interviews while he was in jail, he told reporters that he had documents proving that there was no direct evidence that linked him to the missing girls. He said that the police were withholding evidence that proved that the girls had been murdered by drug dealers and a biker gang. So, of course, the police, no one's really pleased that he's allowed to say these things in interviews. It's really horrendous. So a gag order was imposed after those jailhouse interviews with Weaver. Then Weaver's attorneys tried to get removed from the case. After the request to be removed was denied, the defense attorneys filed a motion saying that Weaver was unfit to stand trial. So he was sent to the Oregon State Hospital for psychiatric evaluation. The motion stating that Weaver was mentally unfit was withdrawn, though, after the evaluation. And the attorneys told the court that Weaver had regained his ability to participate in his own defense.
Now, the case was circumstantial because the autopsies could not prove when, where, or even how the two girls had died. Nevertheless, there is a very strong circumstantial case, and it is believed that a jury would have easily found him guilty. But Weaver never considered pleading guilty until he was denied a change of venue. Then in September 2004, he pleaded guilty to 2 charges of murder and no contest to the remaining charges of sexual assault, rape, and attempted murder. By pleading guilty, he avoided the death penalty, and he was sentenced to 2 life terms with no parole. Weaver tried to say he's pleading guilty out of concerns for his daughter, Mallory. He even held a photo of her while in court. Bleh.
Gross. In late 2002, the Oregon governor ordered a multi-agency investigation into the handling of that first report of Weaver's sexual abuse of Ashley Pond. Everyone wanted to know why this report had not been followed up. A report in the Oregonian verified that the Oregon Child Welfare Department had sent Ashley's molestation charges against Weaver to the wrong police agency. A spokesperson for the State Department of Human Services said that the report had been faxed to the Clackamas County Sheriff's Department erroneously. That agency had no jurisdiction over Oregon City, and they weren't able to find any records of even getting the report. So in 2004, Lori Pond filed a civil case against the state of Oregon, the Oregon Department of Human Services, several individual high-level state employees, Clackamas County, the Oregon City Police Department, and the Chief of Police of Oregon City's Police Department. According to the district court records, the claims were all dismissed. And according to the judge, the case just couldn't go forward because of the danger creation exception. So what is that?
I was just going to ask you.
Yeah. So the danger creation exception requires affirmative conduct on the part of the state defendants to worsen Ashley Pond's situation once the state received the first report of child abuse by Weaver. So, what they do wrong has to actually make her situation worse in order for them to be held accountable, basically. So once the state received the first report, there was an unexplained delay of a couple of weeks in reporting the allegations to law enforcement. And although the state did not increase the level of Ashley Pond's safety, which we would want them to do, right?
Right.
It also did not decrease her safety. So during the state's delay in reporting the abuse allegations to law enforcement, Ashley Pond had remained in exactly the same situation in her mother's care while her mother was aware of Ashley's allegations. So this issue was whether DHS took appropriate actions to protect a child when they learned that her mother had not reported the child's allegations of sex abuse to anyone for more than 2 weeks. But the court said it was not for them to determine. According to the court, the deputy DA, Chris Owen, in Clackamas County, was prosecuting multiple counts of sexual abuse against Wesley Rutger, Ashley's biological father, in August of 2001. Rutger's criminal defense attorney said that Ashley Pond had accused a neighbor, Ward Weaver III, of sexual abuse. The attorney intended to use this information to defend Rutger by casting doubt on Ashley Pond's credibility. Isn't that awful? This is a 12-year-old.
Yeah.
Really makes you hate lawyers, doesn't it? That's terrible. I know you have to do whatever you can for your client, but come on, that's gross.
That is gross.
In other words, this attorney is planning to make a 12-year-old girl look like a liar in court to protect a child abuser. So DA Owen spoke with Lori Pond on August 31st of 2001 about these allegations. Lori Pond and her boyfriend had admitted to Owen that they knew that Ashley alleged that Weaver sexually abused her. Lori admitted that she chose not to report the information to law enforcement. The DA then drove to the Clackamas County Sheriff's Office and called the DHS Child Abuse Hotline to report the allegations made by Ashley against Weaver. Because the DA made this report after the DHS office was closed for Labor Day weekend, the report was forwarded from the hotline to Clackamas County to another county, which was staffed by DHS employees. So on September 4th, 2001, the district attorney and his investigator met again with Ashley. She told them that she was having dreams of being molested, and she thought the dreams were due to the previous sexual abuse by her father. But she said that she then realized that she was not dreaming, and it was actually Weaver who was molesting her. Ashley described 3 incidents of sexual abuse by Weaver, and she also stated that her mother, Lori, already knew that she'd been alleging that Weaver molested her. So it's almost as if Ashley's being punished because her mother's not doing the right thing.
Yeah, well, they're all pointing fingers at each other.
True.
It's not my fault, it's their fault, you know, round and round.
Well, I mean, they're basically saying that Lori didn't protect her daughter, but isn't that why they were called in, to protect the daughter?
Right, but then they're going to say, well, but it didn't worsen, right?
Her condition did not worsen at that point.
Yeah.
But of course it did, she was murdered.
Yep.
Now, immediately after that interview, the DA and his investigator had a second interview with her mother, Lori Pond, who admitted that she had learned of Ashley's allegations against Weaver about 2.5 weeks earlier. Lori Pond again said that she had not reported the allegations to law enforcement. Now, we don't know why.
No, we don't.
Lori Pond's a little suspicious as not being a great mom here.
But she had her own demons too, right?
Oh, absolutely. So she probably had a horrible childhood as well. I mean, all of these people, it seems to go back generations.
Yeah.
That's what makes it so horribly, horribly sad.
But the mother might have been thinking about her own situation when she didn't report her daughter's case.
Absolutely. Or maybe Lori herself had been a victim of sexual abuse and didn't see it as that big of a thing. I mean, I hate to say it, but maybe that's something she was kind of used to in her life, that things like that happened.
Yeah, that's true.
Which is tragic.
So Darlene Walsh, who is a supervisor with the Oregon Department of Human Services in the Children, Adults, and Family Program area, supervised a DHS employee who worked on a child abuse hotline. So Walsh reviewed the actions of the child abuse hotline in response to the complaints, and she confirmed that the report did not involve allegations of abuse or neglect by anyone in Ashley Pond's family or anyone living in Ashley Pond's home. The report was that Weaver, a neighbor of the Pond family, sexually abused Ashley Pond when she was staying at his house to visit Weaver's daughter, Mallory.
Yeah, so DHS had information that Lori Pond knew of her daughter's allegations against Weaver and that she would protect her child from any further contact with Weaver, which of course she didn't. DHS classified these types of allegations as third-party complaints when the parent or parents had physical or legal custody of their child, the alleged abuser did not live in the family home, and the alleged abuse did not occur in the family home, and the child's parents were aware of the allegations and were taking steps to protect that child. And we're not sure what these steps were, other than Ashley wasn't living in the Weaver home anymore. DHS would not remove the children from the home of their custodial parents after receiving a third-party complaint under these circumstances concerning Ashley. So DHS, they said, is not a law enforcement agency and does not have the authority to arrest adults or even initiate criminal prosecutions. I personally thought they could make referrals for that. So there are their reasons for, or excuses, for the state's failure to protect Ashley. You know, maybe I'm naive, but I thought a credible allegation by a child would be enough to arrest Weaver.
Wouldn't you think?
Yeah. According to the civil court, though, DHS was not responsible to protect her because her abuser did not live in her home and because her mother didn't do what she should have done to protect her.
Yeah, I'm sorry. That just boggles my mind.
It does. And even if you hold things against Lori Pond and whatever her demons were, Lori was convinced that Weaver was responsible from the get-go, and no one listened to her. So two Oregon Department of Human Services workers were fired for mishandling reports that Ashley was allegedly sexually abused by Ward Weaver. The punishments for these two caseworkers were from an internal investigation that found the agency fumbled reports that Ashley was abused before she vanished on January 9, 2002. The state probe also found 5 reports were mishandled that dealt with Ashley between January 16th of 2001 and September 18th of 2001.
In 2009, Miranda Gaddis' sister, Mariah, actually spoke with Ward Weaver III twice while he was in prison. He told her that he had gotten Miranda into his house on the morning she disappeared by telling her that Ashley was inside his house and wanted her to help get her home because she was afraid. He also claimed that he targeted Miranda because he thought that she had seen him doing something incriminating that morning. We don't know if that's true, but if it is, pretty horrible to lure this kid in by using Ashley as some kind of bait.
Yes, and apparently he also told Mariah that she was going to be next. So he might have just been fucking with her, because he's just the kind of scumbag that likes to toy with people's minds and get attention. So you really can't believe anything he says, you know?
No.
Ward Weaver III was stabbed while getting a haircut at the Snake River Correctional Institution in 2007. The inmate barber who stabbed him was arraigned on an assault charge. Authorities said that Weaver was stabbed with a homemade shank while getting a haircut. Weaver was treated for his injuries at the prison and didn't require any hospitalization. Now, inmate barbers aren't allowed to use scissors. Haircuts are only given with electric shavers. But we don't know what the motive for this was. You kind of hear that people that victimize children like that are targets in prison. So you have to wonder, was it because of what he had done to the girls, why he was in prison, or was it just some kind of inmate issue? You know, some kind of issue between the two in prison.
Yeah, but they don't like child molesters.
No.
So.
And he's one of the worst.
Yeah.
So that's certainly a possibility. So, Dick, that's the story of Ward Weaver III. If you can believe it, it almost seems unreal.
It does. It seems like it's another example of truth being stranger than fiction.
Yes. Well, fortunately, he'll never be released from prison. But, you know, since then, some other Weaver family members have had their issues. Francis Weaver is the first son of Ward and his first wife, Maria. And he had an unstable childhood because Maria and Ward argued frequently, drank. And after they split up, Francis was moved back and forth between his two parents' homes. Prosecutors argued that 33-year-old Francis Weaver had planned to steal 15 pounds of marijuana from a man named Edward Kelly Spangler in February 2014 with the help of his friend, Michael Oren, and two other co-conspirators. Now, Oren and one of the co-conspirators had approached Spangler's car, which he was inside of, and Spangler was not supposed to be there, apparently, but he was. Oren had a gun. He opened the driver's side door and shot Spangler in his face and in his shoulder. Spangler, still alive, tried to drive away as Oren shot at him again, but his car crashed into a tree and Spangler died from the gunshot wound to the face. At trial, it was revealed that Weaver wanted to return to the scene and get the drugs that had been left behind in the car. Weaver had provided the gun used in the killing after earlier attempts to break into Spangler's vehicle were unsuccessful. Francis Weaver was sentenced in 2016 to life in prison with the possibility of parole after 25 years, and that was for providing the gun that was used in the killing. His mother Maria claimed that her son was framed, but he did already have a criminal history for drug charges and an assault. After he was convicted, Francis apologized to Spangler's family, and he did express regret. He said that Spangler was not supposed to be killed, and that this was the biggest mistake of his life. Now, I personally feel like he isn't quite as bad as his father and grandfather. He did seem to be sorry for what he had done, seemed to have a drug issue. But remember, he wasn't the biological son of Ward Weaver either. But he was raised by him and considered him to be his dad, so he certainly could have picked up some things just from being raised in this family. Michael Oren, the shooter, took a plea bargain and pled guilty to aggravated murder, and he was sentenced to a mandatory 30 years in prison before he would be eligible for parole. The two co-conspirators were convicted of robbery and sentenced to 7 years in prison after taking plea deals. In April 2021, Francis Weaver was granted a new trial after his murder conviction was overturned, and it was overturned because it was decided by the Oregon Supreme Court that Oren's plea bargain agreement violated Francis's constitutional rights. The DA had set up a deal with Oren which strongly discouraged him from cooperating with Francis's attorneys or from testifying for Francis. The DA had gone to Oren and told him not to help Francis, and that his sentence would be reduced. So in October of this year, Francis will get a new trial, but he'll remain in custody until that trial. Francis's attorneys had wanted to call Oren as a witness during his trial, but the judge denied the request after being told Oren would only evoke his Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination, as required by the plea agreement he took. Francis's attorneys tried to enter the agreement into evidence, but the judge denied that request, too.
Mallory has also had a run-in with the law, although far more minor than her male relatives. She's only 12 or 13 years old when her father killed her two friends, so that certainly couldn't have been easy for her. In July 2010, police were dispatched to the Northwest Providence Medical Center in Portland, Oregon, in response to family members attacking hospital security guards. Maria Shaw, Weaver's first wife, was there for treatment for mental health issues. Mallory and her stepfather, Daniel Shaw, showed up at the hospital and tried to forcibly take Maria out of the hospital. They pushed past the nurse and security was called. And then Mallory and Daniel got into a physical altercation with security. Charges were filed against Mallory and her stepfather, Mallory was found not guilty of attempted assault, disorderly conduct, and criminal trespassing. She didn't have a prior record, so even if convicted, she would likely not serve any jail time. Couldn't find anything on Mallory since then, so hopefully she's living a happy life and staying out of prison.
I hope so. I mean, you can't blame her at all. She was friends with these girls. Her father was lying to her.
Yeah.
She was in this environment, and then to realize her own father had killed her two friends.
Right.
After sexually abusing them, I'm sure. Just horrible. So I really do hope that she can find a happy life. It's just quite a story and quite a family.
Sure is.
TCB's music was produced by Mike McClellan, and you can find out more about his work by going to his website, podcastps.com. If you have comments or a case suggestion or a good beer recommendation for Dick, you can send us an email to truecrimebrewery@tigrever.com, or even better, in our opinion, leave us a voicemail. I always put a direct link in our show notes so you can click on that and you can record your voicemail for a future show. So even if you're listening to our show on your iPhone, you can go right to that link, click on it, and record your voicemail right from there. It couldn't be much easier. And we do love to get voicemails. If you're interested in supporting our show and getting episodes ad-free, plus getting a special members-only episode each and every month and a gift, please go to tiegrabber.com and look at our subscribing options. Subscribing is very inexpensive, and there are over 150 shows in our members-only TCB Premium show for your listening and binging pleasure. You also have the option of subscribing through Patreon for the same benefits by going to patreon.com/tiegrabber. Now, either way, you're going to get your own personal subscription link that you can paste into your podcast app, so you can listen there as well as on our website without any commercials or promos. So you know what that means? You won't have to listen to this spiel anymore either, ever, ever. Is that worth it?
Well, of course it is.
I thought so too.
It's time for listener feedback.
Now we have some great feedback to share on the show today. Here's a case suggestion from Cindy.
Hey, Dick and Jill. This is Cindy from the Birmingham Homewood area in Alabama, and I'm really interested in you doing the baby Sterling case. I know pediatrician cases are very close to your heart. Murder of children is close to your heart, and I would love to have you do that on the regular podcast because I'm really interested in this case. I really love how compatible you are together. Really means a lot. I listen to you every week. So anyway, I hope you have a really good year and everything. And I really love what you do. Thanks for all your dedication. And I love how you go into the killer's backgrounds and everything. So you have a really good week and have a really good year. Bye.
Thank you, Cindy. I'm just delighted to get a voicemail from Cindy because she's a frequent writer. She sends us emails quite often with suggestions. And I think we've used several of them over the years.
Yes, we have.
Now, this one she suggested before, and we're kind of hesitant. I'm going to be honest.
Well, you can blame it all on me. I'm not going to do it.
Okay, give us a quick rundown without too many details, because I know it's upsetting.
This was an infant who had basically been starved to death by his parents. And when he succumbed, they just kept his body in a closet or something like that.
Enough said. I get it.
When they finally investigated or looked into the case, there are maggots on the child's body. And it's just, I can't do it. Sorry.
No, I understand. I'm sure things like this happen, and these children deserve to be remembered. But it's a tough one. We do cases about children sometimes, but I guess what we really need to do a case like that is we need to have extensive background on the people who are responsible and what happened as far as their lives, as far as what happened legally, as far as protection of the child. And then it gives us something to discuss. But as far as discussing a child going through such horrors and really not being able to find that much information on the parents or guardians, it's just not an easy one to do. So keep sending us suggestions, though, Cindy. We do appreciate it. We hate to let you down, but I'm sure you'll come up with some more suggestions that we'll be happy to do for you. So let's listen to another voicemail, and this one's from Julie with a case suggestion.
Hi, Jill and Dick. This is Julie from Australia. I listen to your podcast all the time. You always make me want to have a beer too when you're pouring that into those glasses. They sound amazing. I want a story here about Arthur Freeman, a 37-year-old who threw his daughter, Darcy, off a bridge in peak hour traffic here in Melbourne. She fell 58 metres to her death. He was in the car with his two sons as well. He left his wife, apparently, and said, "Goodbye to your children, you'll never see them again." After throwing his child off the bridge, he literally drove himself to the federal court complex. So that would be a really good story to do, just to get into more of his mindset and stuff. I think you could probably find a lot of it on the internet. I know a little bit about it, but it'd be a really good story to cover for your listeners. Something to look into anyway, and hopefully I'll hear it in the future. If not, I'll just keep listening. Please, thank you. Bye.
Thank you very much, Julie. Beautiful accent. We love our Australian listeners. So this is another case that Dick and I have a problem with. Right, Dickie?
Yes.
Or is it just me?
Well, maybe you more than me, but okay. No, we're sharing that together.
Yeah. It's a possibility. I'll look into it and see what we can find on it. Just the whole idea of it makes my blood curdle. It's terrifying. It's horrible. But, you know, it is a true crime show, so it is a possibility.
Right.
But a very disturbing and upsetting case again.
It certainly is.
We're going to need to take a couple weeks off from anything involving children, for certain. But of course, we appreciate it, Julie. And if you think of anything else, let us know. We would love to cover another Australian case.
We certainly would.
So keep us in mind there. And I'm not saying a definite no to this one, but I'm going to give you a maybe on that one.
Well, we'll look into it.
Absolutely. So we're going to do one email?
No, I got one more voicemail.
Oh, another voicemail.
From Michael.
Okay.
And he also has a case suggestion.
Hello. Hi. Okay, I'm good to go. All right. First of all, love your podcast, and I have a case suggestion in Olathe, Kansas. The murder of David Harmon, February 22nd, 1982. And many years later, his wife and family friend, Mark Mengelsdorf, were convicted of his murder. In your research, you'll find interesting motive in regard to all parties being connected to the Mid-America Nazarene University in Olathe, as well as the Olathe Nazarene community. Really kind of crazy. You'll see. I can't go through it all, obviously, in this voicemail, but you'll see. It was featured in a 2016 Dateline titled "A Knock at the Door." It was also a Snapped episode. And I was also hoping you would consider a previous request of mine for an updated look at the 1959 Clutter Murders. Delish. Okay, I see I got a little time. Also, if you could, just let me know. I believe it was your podcast. You guys did an interview in reference to the registration for sex offenders with somebody. I was kind of going through episodes to see which one fit. You actually talked to someone who was kind of involved in the legislation or something. It was an interview, and I wanted to rehear that since some other things have been going on that would fit that. So that's that. Anyway, love your podcast. I find it delicious yet nutritious. And since both the issues are Kansas, obviously not a specific beer, but the brewery is a good one, Free State Brewery, because the brewery is actually one of the breweries that stayed open through Prohibition for various reasons. So I love your podcast. Check you guys later. Bye now.
Thank you, Michael. Now that's like a radio DJ voice full of energy.
Yeah, isn't it? He's really
puts
going.
Us to shame here. Yeah. So what do we know about the case? The Clutter sounds familiar.
Well, that's In Cold Blood.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah, we should do that one. You're right.
Yeah.
Now, what was the other one? The one that had a Snapped and a Dateline.
Yeah, that's David Harmon. Just echoing his information about the connection with the Nazarene Church. I always like dealing with churches and religions.
Okay.
So I thought I'd look that up a little more closely and see if there's some more stuff to do. Usually if there's a 2020 or Dateline episode, we'll find plenty of information.
Yeah, and it's a good way to just watch a quick summary of the case before we decide if we want to investigate it further.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, wait a minute. I wanted to say about the interview. I don't think that was us.
Oh, no. Yeah,
it wasn't us. We've only done a handful of interviews in the past 6 years. It's not a big thing we do, and I'm pretty sure that wasn't us. So we will look into the David Harmon case.
We're going to do that.
And the clutter, I definitely do want to cover at some point soon. So that's a very, very good voicemail. All three of them were wonderful.
Right. We do have one email.
Okay. Do you want to read that?
Sure. This is from Karen, and she has a case suggestion. And this, I'm going to be looking stuff up because this is very interesting. Please consider looking into the 1966 murder of Senator Charles Percy's daughter, Valerie Percy. She was killed in an affluent suburb of Chicago, and her case has never been solved. The neighborhood rumor mill speculates her murderer was local bad seed William Thorson III, who, it is believed, went on to become the infamous serial killer Zodiac Killer. So hometown author Glenn Wall has thoroughly researched the case and presents his opinions in his books, Sympathy Vote and Zodiac Maniac. Perhaps my interest in this case is due to my childhood connection to the area. I think this case has all the elements to air well and air big. I have seen only one episode in one podcast presenting this case. I don't know how difficult it will be to research the case, so I leave it in your very capable hands.
Oh, well, thanks, Karen. So, of course, we've heard of the Zodiac Killer.
I think it'd be something very interesting to look into. I enjoy reviewing old cold cases.
I know you do. You've kind of got a thing for that. Now, we're not really always that interested in doing serial killer cases, just because I feel there are other shows that do a great job at that, and our thing is more to get into the personal stories of individual victims. It's the way I look at it. But if we could delve into Valerie and her case, I'm certainly willing to do that.
Yeah, exactly.
So, great suggestion, Karen. Thank you.
Thanks.
So a big thank you to everyone for listening to us and for sharing your ideas, your case suggestions. We absolutely appreciate it very much, and please keep them coming. And until then, we'll see you at the quiet end.
We'll save some seats for you.
Bye-bye.
Bye, guys.